The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Okay, I'll be with you for the next three times, God willing, and we're going to take roughly one of the major sections each time, the first section being on principles of Old Testament ethics, where we're going to look at the overall framework for approaching the question. I think it's difficult to treat some of the particular texts in a balanced fashion without some reflection on the framework for the approach. And we're going to be looking at it, of course, particularly the debate between theonomists and anti-theonomists, Meredith Klein being one of the more prominent ones that has written vigorously against theonomy. So capital A is an introduction to the two sides. I hope some of you have had opportunity to read some things already. The definitive work on a theonomic approach to Old Testament law is by Greg Bahnsen. Theonomy, his theonomy book. And over against it, there's nothing quite comparable as far as I know. Klein's material on intrusion, he has a chapter or two in the structure of biblical authority. He has a rather scathing review of Bahnsen's book in the Westminster Theological Journal. There's some other scattered things. But let me summarize for the benefit of you that are less familiar. Number one, then, theonomy in summary. Very briefly, okay, because these positions are fairly complex. According to Matthew 5:18, the jot and tittle passage, the law is still in force, including its penal sanctions. That is, the instructions given to civil authorities with regard to punishments for certain crimes. The death penalty for murder, for example, which might not be so controversial, but also the death penalty for homosexual acts, for blasphemy and other things. Some people react emotionally to this, but you got to ask yourself whether that's due to our own humanist environment. So you got to be critical, I think, of your emotional reaction, though it may say something. And note that John Calvin did support the death penalty for blasphemy and some other sacral crimes, or whatever you want to call them, though my personal opinion is that it was not on general principle of the fact that every law had to carry over, but rather that he thought that that agreed with the general equity, general principles of justice. The biggest point, in addition to the particular text in Matthew, is that there is no source for righteous standards in government except in God himself. All the authority which government or any authority has, it has because it is derived from God. How do we say what a state does and does not have the right to do, particularly in a time like ours when totalitarian tendencies in government are so strong? That's a big issue, big issue. Theonomy provides clear answers on social and political ethics and is attractive for that reason. Whether or not you think they're the right answers, it's clear answers, although lately theonomists have been disagreeing among themselves in detail, but I think that is still detail in proportion to the attractiveness of the overall position. Secondly, intrusion, if I may so label Klein's position and that of many of his followers, can be expressed, for instance, in 1 Corinthians 9:20, where the Apostle Paul says, "To the Jews I became like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law I became like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, so as to win those under the law." Now, the point here is that Paul speaks of those under the law and claims himself not to be under the law. So he cannot possibly be dealing with things which apply universally to everyone. And the law of which he speaks is, prima facie, the Mosaic law. And the first response might be, well, Paul is talking about the fact that he's no longer under the curse of the law. And that is true enough. But if so, it's unintelligible how he can say he made himself like one under the law. You couldn't conceive of Paul placing himself again under the curse of the law. What he must be talking about is, at least partially, a respect for Jewish food regulations when he was in the company of Jews. That at least. So he's taught, but the point is not only those Jewish food regulations, he appears in principle he's talking about the law as a coherent structure, not just some piece of the law, and says that he's not under it. That is the background for the Kleinian claim, that among other texts, the background for a Kleinian claim that the law of Moses as a structural whole was a structural part of the Mosaic theocratic geopolitical kingdom, that's Kleinian language, okay, functioning in its whole structure as a type of the eschatological kingdom. That law, then, is fulfilled in antitypical fashion in the consummation of all things. For instance, the holiness regulations. The consummation of all things is perfectly holy. It is the fulfillment, then, of all the holiness material. The penal sanctions are fulfilled in terms of blessing and reward in heaven and in hell. Sanctions in the Mosaic law, then, are seen as an intrusion of the eschaton, and that's where the word intrusion comes from. That is, as an anticipation or projection backward of those standards of penalty which are to be completely fulfilled in the day of judgment and thereafter. So the net effect is to say you must treat the law as a whole and realize that it is not directly applicable to us. It has a typological function. Third point, so that's the summary of the two. Third point under this, however, is that I would urge you to recognize that the principal representatives of these two positions, Bahnsen and Klein, respectively, I would say, there are other people with Bahnsen who are quite competent, the principal representatives are very sophisticated, and they have incorporated many insights that people associate only with the opposite position. All right? It is very easy, I think, for people to caricature or underrate the strength of the position if they've not read or reflected enough on it. And some of what I say, in effect, will be a simplification, but I think it's still useful because there are tendencies, and that some of the popularizations, as it were, some of the followers will show these tendencies in more pronounced form. So in part, some of the critical moves I will be making will apply to the followers and ought not to be seen as the real thing in all its complexity. But I want you to see tendencies at this point. Now, we'll get into the complexities as we deal with particular texts. Capital B, then, concerns normative and situational. Before I go on to that, one more thing. What my approach will be and what I would urge your own approach to be is in conformity with Matthew 5:9. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they should be called sons of God. I mean, I use it that way to try to sympathetically understand and appreciate insights, genuine insights, in both positions without necessarily agreeing with one or the other. Now, you can't possibly agree with both of them because they contradict one another at crucial points. But that doesn't mean that there is no grain of truth to be learned. And that's what I want to show in the next remarks. The strength of theonomy can be summed up in several ways, but one way is to say, Psalm 119, verse 97, "Oh, how I love thy law, O Lord." And somehow it's very difficult to get away from the impression that that's not just legalism, that that's not just some passing kind of thing that belongs to the primitive stage of the Mosaic era, that there is a spiritual dimension to that love. And it goes on and on, of course, in the psalm about that. We must love God's law more than many theonomists themselves do. On the other side, what about the Kleinians, the intrusionists? The basic principle, you might say, is this: even so, come Lord Jesus, Revelation 22, verse 20, or Philippians 3:10. All I care for is to know Christ and to experience the power of his resurrection and growing conformity with his death, if only I'm finally attained to the resurrection from the dead. It is the longing for this intrusion of Christ himself. It's a longing for his coming and seeing everything in the light of his coming. So in that respect, you could say we must love intrusion more than some intrusionists have done. There is nevertheless disagreement, okay, but, and I'll come to that, but you're not going to get very far with hardline representatives of the positions without recognizing some of that appeal, which is, at one level, a genuine biblical appeal. Now, onward to capital B, normative and situational perspectives on God's law. I want to focus on a particular set of passages in the Mosaic law in order to illustrate this principle. The passages that I want you to keep in mind are passages concerning Sabbath breaking and its penalties, penalties for worshiping false gods, Deuteronomy 17:2 and following, penalties for false prophecy and inciting to worship false gods, Deuteronomy 13. They are certain sacral crimes, although how you define them, well, I will leave off till later. And my argument is, on these particular passages, as well as more broadly, the theonomic position tends to be rooted in an approach from the normative perspective. Now, Dr. Clowney has already talked about normative, personal, and situational perspectives. Is that correct? See some nods. Okay. It tends to approach things from a normative perspective, and the intrusionist position to use the situational perspective. Now, don't misunderstand me. We believe, if we understand what the perspective idea is talking about, that the two go together, all right, that there's no disharmony intrinsically. And if you look carefully at Bahnsen and at Klein, the principal representatives, you will see both in there, because they've got to be in there, okay? So these people are not just, you know, completely lopsided. But I nevertheless want you to see what I perceive as a tendency towards the emphasis on the normative perspective in theonomy and the situational perspective, and then with that comes the potential for being unbalanced, noticing only what you want to notice in the Old Testament, okay? If you start with the normative perspective, you're starting already, in some sense, with an emphasis or focus on continuity for all times and places. Because what is a norm if it isn't a norm that applies across the board, that is universal? All right, so you emphasize the universal applicability of the law. Now, Klein would say applicability in its basic principles, and that's part of the dispute, all right? Whereas situations vary, all right? There's discontinuity. And if you want to stress the fact that the law is not directly relevant, the law of Moses, not directly applicable to us, then you stress the discontinuity of our redemptive historical situation, that we are post-resurrection, that we are not the community of Israel as a geopolitical entity, and so on and on. So Klein would point out that Leviticus 20:26, for instance, is talking about what you are to do in the land which the Lord your God has given you. And he would point out the temporal discontinuity that the coming of Christ has, the difference it has made. In addition to that, I think then this sets up a certain tendency towards an isolating treatment of the abiding of the law versus a holistic treatment of it. Let me make that specific. If you believe that the basic thing is continuity, that is, that the law is universally applicable, then the burden of proof is on the other guy to show that if you, when you come to any particular statute, that it is no longer binding. Okay, the assumption is that it's universal until proved otherwise. Whereas the Kleinians would say, look, the whole thing is adapted to the situation, spiritual, typological, and otherwise, of the nation of Israel. The burden of proof is on you to show that any particular statute is not bound up as a total structure with that situation. You see? So it's holistic treatment of the question of the abiding of the law and saying the situation is globally different. Now, in fact, there are a continuum of positions, at least in detail. There are people, as it were, to the right of Bonson, people who will not mix seeds when they sow a field, will not use, what does they call it, hybrid seeds, which they consider a form of mixed seeds, based on the passage about not sowing a field with two kinds of seed in the Old Testament. Now, Bonson doesn't agree with that, and most of you would doubtless say, wait a minute, that's one of those holiness regulations. That's one of those ceremonial regulations. And I'd say to you, how do you know? It's based on creation. At least, you know, it's a person can argue that way. Creation of kinds. All right? So how do you know that a law like that, which is nowhere specifically abolished in the Old Testament, in the New Testament, how do you know that it's no longer binding? So there are people to the right of the Bonson, and there are people to the left of Klein. There are Anabaptists who think that a Christian has no business being an officer of government. There are dispensationalists who emphasize the discontinuity of the Testaments, at least the old-fashioned dispensationalists did. Now, let's see in particular how, this is another point under B, how do these emphases work out in a particular case? Deuteronomy 17:2 and following. If a man or a woman living among you in one of the towns the Lord gives you is found doing evil in the eyes of the Lord your God in violation of his covenant. Okay, and now this is going to lead up to penalties for false worship, all right? But the people who emphasize the situational special character would say, look, this is talking about, sorry, this is from Deuteronomy 13 I'm talking about. 17 is similar. It's one of the towns that the Lord God gives you, but it's 13. It's Deuteronomy 13, and I want for this overhead. 13:2. Yeah, that's right. Let's begin with 13:1. Deuteronomy 13:1. If a prophet or one who foretells by dreams appears among you and announces to you a miraculous sign or wonder, and if the sign or wonder which he has spoken takes place, and he says, let us follow other gods, gods you have not known, and let us worship them. And the Kleinians would say, look, this is talking about people who already know God. But there's a general applicability because there's a sense in which all people know God, according to Romans 1:19 and following. And then you go on, there's this person who's inciting to false worship. You must not listen to the words of that prophet or dreamer. The Lord your God is testing you to find out whether you love him with all your heart and with all your soul. It is the Lord your God you must follow, and him you must revere. Keep his commands and obey him. Serve him and hold him fast. That prophet or dreamer must be put to death because he has preached rebellion against the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt and redeemed you from the land of slavery. Well, now again, you see, this situation is special. It's the people as the holy people who have been delivered from Egypt, the Kleinians would say. There's a special situational character to this law. Then on the other side you'd say, but all receive benefits from God of one kind or another. All right? So that there's a general principle that is more broad. Acts 14:17, you know, God gives, does good and gives to you from heaven rains and fruitful seasons. Let's read on. If you read on, well, the situation is he's inciting to false worship. He's to be put to death. I'll skip to verse 9. You must certainly put him to death. Your hand must be the first in putting him to death, and then the hands of all the people. Stone him to death because he tried to turn you away from the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. The same thing, same note is struck. Then all Israel will hear and be afraid, and no one among you will do such an evil thing again. Israel, all right? But Israel is to be as an example to the other nations, the theonomists would say. Verse 12, if you hear it said about one of the towns the Lord your God is giving you to live in, and the Kleinians would say, look, this is the special land, the holy land, given by God to which these statutes are applicable. And the theonomists say, but all the earth belongs to God, Psalm 24, verse 1. Verse 16, gather all the plunder of the town into the middle of the public square. This is if a whole town goes and worships another god. Gather all the plunder of the town into the middle of the public square and completely burn the town and all its plunder as a whole burnt offering to the Lord your God. It is to be remain a ruin forever, never to be rebuilt. And the Kleinians say, well, look, this also is special to Israel as a holy people offering a sacrifice as a holy priesthood to God. And the theonomists might say Malachi 1:11 indicates that all the nations are to come and burn incense and sacrifice to God. Then 17 mentions the blessing to Abraham, but of course that blessing to Abraham is also to extend to all nations. Genesis 12:3. So the point is you can read the same passage two ways. You can read it and say, this law concerning death to people who incite to false worship, this law is applicable only in this special situation of Israel as holy people, land given by God, all those elements, okay? And then you have become a Kleinian, all right? Because you are sensing the uniqueness of the geopolitical kingdom of Israel as typological of the consummation and so on. But if then you're a theonomist, you say, but all of this is to be exemplary for the type of thing that is to go on universally because Israel is to be the center from which the law is to go out to all nations. If you want to extend the general argument can be summed up as I've got at the bottom of this overhead, that the normative side tends to commit you to saying the law is universal. There is nothing special about Israel. If it is indeed true that Israel is holy, then it is holy as a model for what all the other nations ought to be. The situational perspective, on the other hand, tends to push you in the direction of saying Israel is special. God is uniquely present in the midst of Israel in the way that he is not among all other nations. And that unique presence of God and the unique history of deliverance from Egypt and so on demands changes in the penology, perhaps all the way down the line. Why? Because God's intensive presence brings intensive sanctions. Then the normative perspective, or rather the theonomists emphasizing that perspective, might reply, when the nations look at the law of Israel, they supposedly say that it is wise and just. Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 6. Observe them, that is the laws, carefully, for this will show your wisdom and understanding to the nations who will hear about all these decrees and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. What other nation is so great as to have their gods near to them the way the Lord our God is near us whenever we pray to him? What other nation, so on, has such a righteous decrees and laws as this body of laws I am setting before you today? In other words, the other nations ought to sit up and admire the righteousness of these laws in Israel. So the Theonomist says, clearly, these laws have universal applicability. And then the intrusionist comes back and says, yes, the nations are to look at Israel and say, those are righteous laws, which would be the right thing for us if we were that special people of God, which, of course, we're not. So that for the intrusionist, the attitude of the nations is, if I may compare it, it's something like the attitude of angels looking on and seeing the commandment not to commit adultery and saying that is really a righteous law for human beings. And if we were human beings, we would enjoy having that law. But of course, we're not. So it's not applicable to us. Well, that's it's not the same thing. But I'm trying to convey the idea that an intrusionist would say, look at the same passage and be able to affirm just as strongly, yes, indeed, the nations ought to recognize the wisdom and righteousness of these laws, but the question is, righteous for who, you see? And the one sees it as a universal thing, and the other sees it as situationally limited to Israel. Then there are also disputes, sticky disputes, I believe, with regard to our own modern situation. The intrusionists would say, in our situation, which is inevitably an evangelistic situation of mixture, where we hope many people will become Christians, but we're not to drive out the non-Christians from our midst. We are not to separate ourselves from unbelievers, spatially, politically. And if you press it, you'll say, what would the Jews' reaction be? Wouldn't they be reminded of Nazi Germany or the medieval Jewish ghetto by this kind of approach? Though there are many questions involved there. I used to think that was terrible danger, but now I've begun to see certain theonomists might say, the Jews intend to worship the true God, even though they worship without a true knowledge. So it's debatable whether the Jews would have to be persecuted for false worship, even under a theonomic understanding. Well, the normative, or rather the theonomic approach then says, there is a teaching function of public law. It embodies the justice of God. And in that way, it will actually aid evangelism. And they would also point out that certain people in our situation might be willing to live in a nation that had these laws, even though they didn't like it, because they were, liked other things about the situation, just as there were sojourners who were willing to live in Israel.
Next general point, and this is D in your overall outline. C, rather, burden of proof. Well, I've somewhat covered that because the question is, if you look at things from a theonomic perspective, you emphasize the norms, then the burden of proof is on the other guy to show that with respect to any given statute of the Old Testament, it's no longer binding. If you come at things as an intrusionist and you sense primarily the overall structure, the global structure of the law is adapted to unique elements in the nation of Israel, you say the burden of proof is on the other guy to show that any particular statute is universal. Now, some of them clearly are. The capital punishment goes back to Noah's time, it's clearly not just specific to Israel's situation, but other things you have to struggle with. Now, my own position, as you may have guessed, is that it is not useful in the long run to appeal to the burden of proof. Because burden of proof is a way of evading the hard questions. it's a way just of saying, I won't challenge my own biases. There's another element in all this, under the burden of proof too, and that is concerning the very nature of proof itself. And here again, I think there's a difference in atmosphere in these two approaches. In the theonomist approach, you will find, and again, the leaders are better at it, but I'm talking about tendencies. In the theonomist approach, you will find a preference for isolating, as it were, casuistic treatment, and I'm not using that in a pejorative sense, because I think we must look at detail, isolating casuistic treatment of the law. That is, the law piecemeal. Now, there's some variation that Ohio, Texas people, I think, are much better on this score. That goes together with, I think, then, a minimization of context. In other words, a particular statute is what it is, and to understand it, you don't really need very thorough or deep reflection on the context. There is also a preference for tight-knit logical argumentation as opposed to a more pictorial, metaphorical, or analogical argument. Or if I may put it another way, for an appeal to analytical precision as against intuitive sense of the whole. Now you see, intuition, things that we don't make entirely explicit in a rationalized fashion, intuition can be more sensitive many times to a background of context that is quite large. You see, that is part of the issue, right? Because the intrusionists say that context is all essential to really appropriating the law in the way it is intended to be understood. You don't really understand the law if you don't understand its typological depth. See? And that typological depth is a function of how it fits into a global context in the whole Old Testament and the Mosaic era. That leads to a style of argumentation, your typical sort of biblical theology, which throws around, you know, a lot of pictures, a lot of metaphors, a lot of loose vocabulary. You read Bonson, it's the style of analytic philosophy. It's tight-knit arguments with no holes, all right? But that kind of tight-knit stuff depends on your having statements which are not qualified by a context. So I'm saying there's a tendency here, I think, to a different style of argumentation. Now, let me say, there are dangers in both approaches to the nature of proof. There are dangers in the isolating kind of approach of not seeing the weightier matters of the law, to use the phrase of Jesus' teaching, or of being insensitive to situational qualifications, today as well as back then. Harshness, in other words. You've all met people, and need not be theonomists or infusionists or anything else, who just will slap down an answer on somebody else without really understanding their problems. Okay? So the question is, are we going to create that kind of thing? And that's been one of the afflictions, of course, of theonomy, and it's like the church, that there's been church splits and stuff over it, which I think are not entirely due to the theological position, but due to the arrogance of some of the representatives. Some of them, all right? Don't paint with a single broad punch, brush. And the same might be said, you know, on any position, it's going to have bad representatives as well as the good ones. Calvinists have it. Arminians have it. You know, it's true of any kind of position like that. There is dangers then in the isolating approach. There is dangers also in this more pictorial, intuitive kind of biblical theological approach of being swayed by beautiful pictures of what you would like to be the case, but may not really be the case. There is a danger then of introducing subjectivity in these looser kinds of arguments. And there's danger, in terms of the situation, of being so sympathetic to excuses in the modern situation that punishment is indefinitely postponed. You become a wishy-washy representative of lack of principle, and there's plenty of those people around. Or you become insensitive to the universal bearing of the particulars of Scripture. narratives, historical narratives even, have lessons for now. See, even though they are quite particular, it's something that happened only once. So, it's not easy. Now, finally, it's not quite finally. Moreover, there are also dangers in reaction to our culture. I think the anti-theonomists are in danger of succumbing uncritically to the moods of our culture and refusing to take seriously the standards of God that involve, you know, the political arena. Whereas the theonomists may be in danger, and again, it will vary from person to person, I'm not painting with the same brush everybody, there's a danger of reacting to the opposite extreme of so detesting the bad elements in our culture that you're unable to learn anything from it. In a sense, this whole question of proof can also be seen as revolving around the question of the generality of the principles articulated in the Mosaic Law. Now, if you don't come away with anything else, this is perhaps a sufficient thing all by itself to get you a long way. So listen. The question is really, you can see the whole debate, in some sense, as a question, to what level of generality do you have to rise to obtain universal principles of justice? That is, here you have a statute, don't mix two kinds of seed. There is a principle involved there, right? Principle of holiness and separation, which is still valid. Do not unite yourself with unbelievers. It's valid on that level, okay? So if you rise to a general principle of holiness, then you can find an application for even that statute today. The question is how far, how general you have to become until you find something that's universal. Is it just universal as it stands? In other words, is that a creation principle that means then that mixing seeds is an undermining of the creation order? And you know, when I put it that way, you see, even that, although I'm perfectly clear, I don't think that's applicable now, that you could produce arguments that look fairly plausible to the effect that it is applicable. Or you might say that any statute whatsoever in the Old Testament embodies the principle, love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul, strength and mind, and your neighbor as yourself. Therefore, it's applicable to you and to me. Right? But that's fairly trivial, isn't it? Well, I mean, it's not trivial to obey it. But at that level, you can say it's not a debate over whether the Old Testament law is still binding on it. Clearly, at that level of generality, it is. It's the question of where you reach the appropriate level of generality where it does become binding on us. Even the statutes, then, to which the theonomists appeal have relevance at some general level, but the question is, how far do you generalize? To take another example, you're supposed to put a railing around the roof when you build a house. Does that mean we would build houses with railings around our roofs? That would be a minimal level of generalizing. All right? Bunsen says, he penetrates to a purpose behind that and says, well, it's to protect people from falling off the roof because they socialize, it's called like a patio kind of area in the ancient Near East. So the application is build a fence around your swimming pool. It's protecting life. The general principle is protecting life. But you see, there you have to rise to that general principle of taking pains to protect life in order to get an application. And, the application Bonson comes up with is more specific, of course, which is it's protecting life by putting protections around dangerous things. So he's not quite as general as simply protecting lives, right? He's a little more specific. You can see you've got a whole spectrum of possible levels of generality of principle. The very top is to love God and love neighbor, and the very bottom is the thing in all its specificness. Now, I don't think there's any easy answer, frankly. If you're going to expect the next two lectures to solve anything, the answer is you must understand God, and you must understand what he's saying in the whole Bible in depth. That's how you understand how these details apply to you. All right? But at that level, you say, you've got to say, well, we've got work to do. You know, and we're never going to come to the end of it until the Lord returns. So I think, if nothing else, this whole controversy can be a stimulus to say, you really got to work at understanding the Bible. You see, part of that context issue is also the issue of, is the Bible, if I may exaggerate the theonomic position, is the Bible a kind of legal textbook or statute book? Or is it vocally proclaiming the death and resurrection of Christ in the whole of the Mosaic structure? If it is, you're going to misunderstand every single statute if you don't keep in mind that Christological focus. So at that level, I'm going to come back to this, but at that level you can say, it is not a debate over whether the Old Testament law applies to us. This is a debate over the meaning of the Old Testament law, over understanding it. Because the Kleinians, among others, would say you don't even understand it if you don't understand how it points to Christ. Relevant to some of your other courses. Okay. Now, what I'm going to do in the remainder of this hour is to try to show you, again on the level of principle and more or less ignoring some of the details and sophistication of Klein and Bonson, to show you that if you take the foundational principles of the two positions, that they are perspectives on one another. Okay? So I'm going to start with the principle. What are the foundational principles? Foundational principle of justice, oh how I love thy law, O Lord, and that all of God's law is just and it's the only standard of justice. And the principle of intrusion, I've called it, but I would like to rename it visitation of the presence of God, and particularly the coming of God in special sense, above all at the last judgment. So, capital D, justice, that is, theonomic justice in the proper sense of the word, God's justice as embodied in his law, God's justice, then, as the foundation for intrusion, if you will, visitation. Under this, then, point one is that justice is absolutely foundational to God's own action. Psalm 97:2, righteousness and justice are the foundation of your throne. That is, they are the foundation of God's rule over the universe. But we must also recognize that God's justice is not a hidden blank to us as human beings. It is covenantally revealed, if you will. Abraham in Genesis 18:25 and the surrounding passage appeals to the fact that God must be just. Shall not the judge of all the earth be right? And says, will you destroy the righteous and the wicked? In other words, he's calling upon God to be loyal to not some abstract principle of justice, that would be alien to biblical thinking, but to God's own character as just, which has been revealed to Abraham. Now, Abraham understands the awkwardness of the situation, lying by dust and ashes, but nevertheless he goes ahead because God has been gracious to reveal his promises and his character to Abraham, and Abraham can appeal to that. I'm saying that because I think there's sometimes a tendency in certain theonomists to say, don't try to understand the law, let's just obey it. And I think that is somewhat a distortion of understanding of what the authority of God, divine authority of God, means. That it is not something that is just brute for us, but something that God has condescended to reveal to us, in a measure, not exhaustively. We're not the standard God is, but nevertheless God has told us
something of his justice, and we can appeal to him as Abraham did. This justice of God is not limited to one class of beings. It applies to native and sojourner, to rich and poor alike in the land of Israel. It applies even to animals and to the land itself. When you look at the command to Sabbath rest, for example, the animals in the land must also rest. It applies to the exodus from Egypt, that God's acts of judgment are just. It applies to Mount Sinai, where any animal who touches the mountain must be stoned. It applies to the priests, who will be killed if they do not approach the holy place with the proper qualifications. It applies to the conquest under Joshua, as well as to the post-conquest period. It covers the manner of establishing the judgeship and the rulers, the human rulers in Israel. Hence, differing situations must be accounted for. All right? How do you account for Mount Sinai and the priesthood if the law, the justice of God is truly universal? See, I'm pressing on the theonomous on principle and saying, you really believe it? All right? Then you believe it with respect to Mount Sinai. You believe it with respect to the priesthood. And why is that situationally different? You know, how do you account then for the different penalties which come into play at Mount Sinai and with respect to the priesthood? Answer: God is your closest neighbor. The intensity of your fellowship with God makes a difference in your degree of responsibility. Everyone to whom much is given, of him will much be required. Luke 12:48. That is a law principle, all right? It is a justice principle. It's very deep, as I'll argue later. That begins to explain why the priests are treated as special, all right? Because they are set apart as holy. They are more intensively related to the presence of God, and with that comes a greater responsibility to maintain their purity, and similarly with Mount Sinai. So I say the very principles of justice themselves articulate why the presence of God makes a difference. Intrusion, you see, comes right in. In the New Testament, of course, all the earth is brought into relationship to Christ's dominion. All authority in heaven and earth has been given to me, he said. Hence, wouldn't you expect an intensification of the penalties? And the answer is yes, and that's what the last judgment is about. But at this point, I think it's too early to ask what kind of connection that has on human governments in the New Testament, which is the question which theonomists are wanting to answer. Now let's start the other way and use visitation, the coming of God, as our foundational principle, as the basis for justice, and that's part E here. Now, under this, then, point one is, there is no justice on an autonomous basis. Autonomy, in the Vantillian sense, postulates justice which is universal, irrespective of the presence of God or even the existence of God most of the time in modern philosophy, okay? If they think you can talk about justice, maybe out there or in here or somewhere anyway, whether or not God exists. That is not biblical. That is an illusion. Alright? Biblical justice is justice before God's face. That is, it is grounded in the faithful presence of the Son before the Father, if you want to deal with ultimate Trinitarian categories, and in the fact that God, as the Creator, fills all things and holds people responsible as the one who is present in all creation. That's point one. Point two, every just penal infliction is an intrusion or visitation of the presence of God. That is, it is a coming of God in judgment. Yeah, really. got everything in terms of genealogy right there in terms of coming to God. Why do I say that? Isaiah 10, verse 5, "Ah, Assyria, the rod of my anger, the staff of my fury." All right? Assyria bringing judgment on Israel is God bringing judgment. It's God coming to Israel. And doesn't it follow just from basic principles as well? God has all authority. Hence, the only way there can be punishment is by God being present. That is just punishment, is by God being present to do it. And of course, he is present in the governmental authorities, according to Paul, Romans 13, right? They are authorities appointed by him who are his representatives in bringing punishment, and that is what is the authorization for the justice involved in. Third point, you could even do it more broadly. Creation is a visitation of God on chaos. Well, of course, God created chaos too, but Genesis 1:2, the Holy Spirit comes, all right, and is present in creation. And there is, in a broad sense, a just order, not literally, but in a sense of fitness or rightness, the way in which things are established by that visitation of God and by his abiding presence, not only personally, but through man as his representative in the Garden of Eden. The presence of God climaxes at the consummation of all things. Hence, every pre-consummation presence of God is an intrusion of the consummation. All right, so now I've got everything as categorized in terms of visitation. Martin?
You speak of judgment of God as if, I mean, throughout history, as if it's disconnected from his judgment in Christ or on Christ. What's the difference between God's, maybe it's just...
No, I'm not trying to isolate them, because the
is there not
death and resurrection...
difference in the character of God's judgment on mankind prior to...
Oh, yeah. We're coming to that.
Okay, all right.
Because we have to recognize the centrality of the death and resurrection of Christ as judgment and justice of God, which brings victory and redemption, and the meaning of that cosmically, if you will. But I'm holding off on that because it's so rich and complex an area. Let me introduce one more point. The punishment is the more severe, the more intensive the presence of God. And that follows, again, everyone to whom much is given, him will much be required, kind of thing. It is unjust to have equal penalties at every point where responsibility is unequal. So this is beginning to sound as if the law of Moses itself demands that different penalties be used outside of Israel in cases related to the mode of God's presence in Israel. Now that's the little peek into what's coming.